Hi, this is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I want to welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. I'm in Missouri this week, conducting the updated or the new Life Unlimited series, having a great time here. We've got a good crowd that's showing up every night, and a lot of good things are happening. This week, we're going to be discussing a topic in relation to Jesus' peace teachings that we've received quite a few requests to address, and that's the topic of domestic violence. Our thought text that we're going to be looking at is in Matthew 5:39, where Jesus says, "But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also." Now, I've personally witnessed a lot of damage against both women and children that's been done because of a complete misunderstanding of Jesus' meaning in this passage. And I want to say from the very beginning of this week that I've not been trained in counseling. I don't have a PhD in psychology or psychiatry. And therefore, I'm not going to be approaching this topic academically. My qualifications for speaking on this topic, I think, go a lot deeper than just academic training. And it may be those very qualifications that have caused me to drag my feet a little bit on this topic and be putting it off for as long as I have in this series. It's very personal for me, and I want you to know that going into this. Many of you know that I grew up in a broken home, and I share a little bit of my story in the first chapter of my book, Finding the Father. But the part that I don't share publicly, and I don't think I've ever shared publicly before, actually, is that the next man that my mother married after my father, it's not the man she's married to now, but the man she's married to now is probably the most humble, self-sacrificing, gentle man I've ever met. But the marriage to the man my mother married after the divorce from my father was quite a different story. I have quite a few memories, some of them very fuzzy, that I'm sure I've purposefully pushed away. But I have memories of times where my mother and I would go and live for extended periods of time with my grandmother because of a beating or some type of violence that my mother had received from my stepfather. My grandmother was such a quiet, other-centered, gentle follower of Jesus. She was a prayerful woman. I remember her praying every day for me and for my cousins and for her children. And I could never picture her growing up being able to hurt anyone. Matter of fact, I was really quite shocked the night that this story took place. I remember my stepfather trying to break down her back door to storm in and get to my mother, and I remember being very scared that night too. I was, I was hiding just around the corner, and able only to see a little, but I saw enough. I was very familiar with my stepfather's temper, and I knew that if he got through that door that evening, something terrifying was going to take place. I remember my little grandmother appearing out of her bedroom and striding toward the door. She unlatched the chain, followed by the deadbolt. Then she swung open the door and pulled out this gun. I didn't even know my grandmother owned a gun, but she pulled out this gun and put a bullet in the wall beside the door. And then I heard her say in a tone a voice that I had never heard come from my grandmother before. She said, "You touch my daughter tonight, and the next bullet will be in you. You just think long and hard about what you do next. Jesus loves you, son, but you're real close to meeting him personally." I remember him backing up at that point and just simply leaving. And I never looked at my grandmother the same way after that day. I remember when I was 8 years old, I saw my stepfather's temper again. My mother's back was turned to him, and she couldn't see what was coming, but I saw him lose it, and I could see what was about to happen. I remember jumping over the kitchen counter to intercept the blow in midair, and the blow that was intended for my mom ended up falling on me instead. And then he turned his rage on me and left bruises on my back that took the better part of a month for them to finally go away. I remember spending a year on the road when I was probably around 9 or 10 even, maybe even 11. I remember spending a year on the road living out of the trunk of our car, in and out of one women's shelter after another. It was a real scary year for me, a very scary year for me. I went to 6 different public schools that year. Sometimes, again, we stayed in women's shelters. Sometimes we slept at the home of friends. Other nights we just slept in the car. When he'd find us, and he somehow always did find us, we'd have to quickly move on. My mother finally left this man when I was 12. I remember him leaving for work, And 10 minutes after he was gone, the movers showed up. My mother had been left with nothing before, and she was not going to be found in that place again. The movers packed up everything that was hers, and we were gone. We were leaving North Carolina and moving back to West Virginia to live with my grandmother again. But this time was different. My mother never went back to him. She was finally done, and she never went back to him again. I've seen firsthand well-meaning pastors and friends who use Matthew 5 to justify women staying in dangerous domestic situations. I've seen this passage used in ways that leave women who are living with domestic violence. I've seen it used to leave those women living with the domestic violence at the hands of their husbands as little more than just a doormat. I've seen this verse abused in ways that have enabled violent husbands to do years of emotional and physical damage to women and children in their lives. And I want to say first and foremost right now that if you're in danger and you're being victimized by domestic violence, get out. Take yourself and your children and get to safety. But what does the above passage even mean then? And I want to be clear. Nowhere in Jesus' words in Matthew 5 does he belittle the worth of a person who's being abused by domestic violence, encouraging her to just take it. Quite to the contrary, what Jesus is actually teaching is the exact opposite. Jesus' words in Matthew 5, when understood correctly and applied to domestic violence, are about responding to violence, even domestic violence, in ways that don't belittle the value of either party involved, but instead respond in ways that respect and restore the value of both. We typically see within domestic violence only one party who needs reconciled. And while Jesus' teachings don't deny that, the teachings of Jesus in Matthew 5 call us to see not just one party in need of being rescued, but two. And let me share with you again what I shared in part 3 of this series, but with a special application to domestic violence. We must be clear. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is showing that the goals of his kingdom cannot be accomplished by violence. Rejection of violence, however, ought not to be interpreted as, once again, as we've said over and over again in this series, ought not to be interpreted as passivity. In other words, being passive. Pacifism is not being passive. Far from counseling a woman who's being abused by her husband to simply become passive, Jesus' statements about turning the other cheek and giving the cloak and going the second mile actually teach an assertive and confrontational nonviolence that provides her abuser with an opportunity for transformation and change. If you take Matthew 5 seriously, the oppressed woman actually has the potential to seize the initiative. And if taken literally, sometimes even shame her offender, not in the heat of a moment, though, mind you, but to bring shame and strip her abuser of the power to continue dehumanizing her. And let me show you how. Jesus said, "If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also." The only natural way for a blow to land on the right cheek was for the back of the hand to be used. Such a blow in this culture would show an insult by a superior to an inferior. In this culture in which Jesus was using this example, one would not strike an equal in this humiliating way. Doing so carried an exorbitant fine. Now try to picture the scene in your head. It might make it easier to understand what I'm saying. Since the left hand was only used, for unclean tasks in this culture. If you've ever been in a developing country, you understand what I'm talking about. Hitting the right cheek with the left hand would not occur. In other words, you wouldn't be hitting with a closed fist with the left hand. You never touched anyone with your left hand, but you had options when it came to striking them with your right hand. If you used a closed fist, this would indicate that you saw the person you were striking as an equal, and your blow would therefore land on their left cheek. Again, a blow from a closed right fist on the left cheek acknowledged that the one being struck was viewed by their striker as an equal. Thus, a supposed superior, like a master over a slave, a husband over a wife, a parent over a child, a Roman over a Jew, a man over a woman, would specifically never want to strike an inferior with the closed fist. to be struck on the right cheek, as Jesus is referring to here, required that the one striking required them that to strike you not with a closed fist, but with an open backhand. For that blow to fall on your right cheek, they had to slap you backhanded. And a backhanded blow to the right cheek had the specific purpose of humiliation. A blow in retaliation would invite retribution, but I want you to notice that Jesus didn't say, just roll over and take it. Jesus told us to respond by turning and in rebellion, offering the oppressor the proper cheek or the left cheek, showing that the supposed inferior refused to be humiliated. With the left cheek now bared, the striker would be left with two options, either a left-handed blow and be regarded as unclean themselves, or a blow with a closed fist, which would agree that the person being struck was their equal. Since neither option was acceptable to the supposed superior, the person striking, they lost the power to dehumanize the other person. We're seeing here that Jesus not only taught the theory of nonviolence, but then he gave us real examples of how to apply this theory in ways that do not dehumanize the victim either. Notice the response is still nonviolent. It's still a nonviolent response, but it's a response that restores the dignity of the one being struck. And this doesn't even begin to look at how he then modeled the theory of nonviolence throughout his entire life and ultimately his death as well. Now let's look at the next example Jesus used. And again, we covered this in part three, but we're going to go over it again here because we're making a special application to domestic violence. A court of law constitutes the setting for Jesus' injunction about giving the cloak or the undergarment along with the outer coat. The law allowed a creditor to take the coat or the outer garment as a promise of future payment only from a poor person without the means to pay the debt. You can see this in Exodus 22, 25 through 27, and Deuteronomy 24, 10 through 13, and verse 17. Only the poorest person would have only an article of clothing to surrender as security. Since the coat was likely the debtor's sole remaining article of clothing, the wealthy creditor had to return it each evening for the owner to sleep in. Further, in that society, the shame of nakedness, you have to understand when someone's naked, the shame of nakedness fell more on those who were viewing the nakedness or those that caused it rather than on the person who was actually naked. You can remember Noah's son Ham. Go back and read that story in Genesis. You can see that Ham was the one that received the greatest shame for looking on his father's nakedness. The shame wasn't on the father for being naked, but on his son for looking at it. And remember that most people only had, once again, two articles of clothing. They didn't wear underwear in those days. Thus, stripping off the undergarment in the public setting of the court, along with the required outer garment, would have, in effect, been turning the tables on the wealthy creditor. It would have put the poor person in charge of the moment while exposing the exploitative system and shaming the wealthy and the powerful person who's taking their last object of value from the poor person. Jesus is actually here, and I know this is challenging to some of our more conservative friends, but Jesus is actually here endorsing public nudity. It's a radical act of protest. It's a nonviolent protest, but whether we like it or not, Jesus is here recommending streaking with a cause as a viable option rather than returning violence with just more violence. And let's look at Jesus' third example before we end this too, and then we're going to make special application. Going the second mile had a great power to embarrass a Roman soldier who compelled the first mile. Roman law allowed soldiers to command at will the forced labor of carrying burdens for 1 mile, but it limited that service to just 1 mile. The limitation provided some protection for the occupied people. If one followed Jesus' words and cheerfully carried a burden beyond the required first mile, it actually put the soldier in an awkward position of not complying with the limit that was imposed on them by their superior. As a result, the soldier could end up in an embarrassing position of begging the civilian to put down the burden, lest the soldier themselves be disciplined for that second mile. You have to imagine the follower of Jesus at this time, at this moment, saying back to the soldier, no, I'll cover you. If you get in trouble, I'll vouch for you that I volunteered. And then you have to imagine what kind of discussion would take place between that soldier, a Roman soldier, deeply despised by Jewish, used to being despised by Jewish people. What kind of conversation would take place between that soldier and that Jewish person for that during that whole second mile as they walk together? Try to get your head around what Jesus is actually teaching in these three examples. Jesus's followers are encouraged to offer the left cheek. They're encouraged to, if need be, take off all your clothes to show the reality of what's happening here. They're encouraged to go the second mile to put soldiers in a position where they have to wake up to what's taking place. In each of these cases, Jesus' instructions are not commands of passive non-resistance. The phrase, resist not an evildoer, could be problematic if Jesus didn't then demonstrate what he meant by these three stories, by this phrase, resist not an evildoer. The actual Greek word here for resist is anthistomai. It indicates, again, and we covered this in part three, but it indicates resistance by returning violence for violence, overcoming evil with evil rather than overcoming evil with good. Anthistomai is a violent resistance. But Jesus was teaching that in rejection of violent responses, we shouldn't go to the other extreme and not resist evil in any way. He was telling his followers to simply resist in a nonviolent fashion. Was he telling his followers to do nothing? Again, absolutely not. Jesus was teaching nonviolent ways for oppressed people to take the initiative, to affirm their humanity, to expose and neutralize exploitative circumstances. Jesus is demonstrating nonviolent ways in which people at the bottom of society or under the thumb of imperial power, how they could act. And I would add, even precious people who are being abused by their spouses can learn to recover their humanity while at the same time reach out and redeem, even restore those who, even though they are the oppressors, they also are the victims of systemic evil and the violence of our culture. Let me be very clear this week. If your spouse is abusing you, get yourself and your children to safety. Also, I can't say this strongly enough. You must get others involved. You cannot do this alone. Let me also add, too, we're not to respond to our abusers violently. Don't respond to him with more violence. Don't try to fight back physically. Violence will only escalate. A violent response to your abuser will only fuel their anger and many times make matters worse. But remember, Jesus didn't teach you that because your response is not violent, that there shouldn't be a response at all. He doesn't tell you to just take it. Don't respond with more violence. But their abuse of you does demand a response. Love demands that you respond. But love also dictates the manner of that response. Jesus demonstrated in principle ways of forcing your abuser to recognize your worth and value. His illustrations in these three stories would cause the abuser to face the ways that they dehumanize you, and even through means that may cause them shame and embarrassment, they had to come to terms with what they were doing. Remember, Jesus died for you. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing right now, whatever you're going through, Jesus died for you. You must become submitted to the value that Jesus places on you, regardless of your spouse's treatment of you. I know you love your spouse, and I know this part is very difficult. Jesus died for them too. And if your motive is also to help your spouse, you must set in motion realities that will enable them to see their own victimhood to their own temper, that they're a victim of their own anger, their own addiction to violence, their own enslavement to belittling and dehumanizing women and children through their treatment of their spouse and children. Again, you cannot do this all by yourself. You need others to help you. You need to, at the very minimum, get a counselor involved. Stop protecting and enabling your abuser, and begin today, even if it's just the choice right now to begin looking for help, begin today to move in a direction that's going to call them to become accountable and hopefully even rescued and redeemed from their own behavior. At the same time, you've got to be careful. If they don't respond, don't take on a form of guilt. You're not the one to blame here. Remember, though, at the same time that you're not responsible for how they respond, you are responsible for how you respond. There are two people here who need to be rescued. And if there are children involved, they're even more involved than just two. Let me just stop for a moment and just talk about kids. Without negating the sanctity of marriage, it is much better for children to live in a peaceful home with one loving parent than an abusive home with two parents. If one parent is abusive, that is a horrible burden for a child to bear. And if the parent being abused gives tacit permission to the abuse by not doing all they can to prevent it, even at the cost of separation, that gives the child a message that the abuse must be normal and okay, and very likely, statistics show that child will grow up to abuse your grandchildren or allow themselves to be abused by their spouse. I know it takes courage, and I know you love your spouse, the spouse that's hurting you, but you must, for the sake of your children, teach your children too clearly that abuse is not acceptable, even and especially at the hands of a parent. You can stand for the sanctity of your marriage and your vows without allowing physical or verbal abuse to hurt yourself or your children. You can communicate to your spouse that you love him and you want your family to be together, but because the abuse is damaging the family, you and your children will need to live separately from him. Boundaries must be set and boundaries must be kept. And if your spouse insists on defending rather than turning from his abusive behavior, then he's the one who's breaking up the marriage, not you. Don't take that guilt on yourself. God, too, has experience with domestic violence. And sometimes when we set healthy boundaries and then reach out to an abusive spouse, even with the best of intentions of reconciliation, we get the same response that God did when he reached out to Pharaoh. Sometimes the act of calling attention to the situation causes the abusive spouse's heart to harden. But again, whether the spouse responds to reconciliation or redemption, or whether they respond by digging in their heels and becoming even more entrenched, you're not called to be passive. Christian pacifism is about pacifying. It's not about being passive. To pacify means to bring peace, restoration, redemption, to seek to save all parties that are involved. And while domestic violence is taking place, while we're allowing domestic violence to take place, peace is not present. Now, again, as a victim of domestic violence myself growing up, I can say firsthand, the one who is being the conduit of the abuse needs to be rescued just as much as the ones who are being abused. But you must respond in a way that truly rescues and doesn't enable further abuse. You are right to remember that your spouse is not the enemy. Paul said very clearly in Ephesians 6:12 that we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I know you love your spouse, and I know you want to do things to protect your spouse, but your spouse is currently being a conduit of the enemy to hurt you and to hurt your children. And if you truly love your spouse that is hurting you, you must respond in a way that calls them to account. I have witnessed too many women who continue to put themselves and their children in harm's way because they cared, so to speak, about protecting their husbands. If the words of Jesus in Matthew 5 mean anything in the context of domestic violence, Jesus would call you to, number one, protect yourself and your children, get to safety. Number two, don't respond with violence, but do not allow yourself to continue to be dehumanized either. And number three, set in motion realities that will cause your spouse to wake up, to become accountable, to embrace change, even if it brings shame and embarrassment to them. If this requires beginning with separation, living separate in separate locations, so be it. Your spouse must come to terms with the reality that they are destroying their family. And when you stick around, it only hides the situation and allows your spouse to pretend that things are something that they're not. I have seen abusive spouses turn and change, with Jesus' help, as a result of steps taken by the abused spouse. I've also seen spouses who were unwilling to change. But regardless of what the outcome may be, Jesus never taught that women and children should passively allow themselves to be dehumanized by domestic violence and abuse. I know it takes courage. I know change is scary. Don't do this alone. Get others whom you trust involved. You are of infinite worth to Jesus. He gave everything for you. And I know you love your spouse, but you too are Jesus' most prized and precious daughter. Wherever this finds you today, embrace how much you are truly worth to Jesus. And without denying the worth of the one who's hurting you, with God's strength given you in Jesus Christ, get help. Break the cycle for you and for him and for your children as well. I'm wishing each of you this week the restorative, nonviolent peace and love of the kingdom. I love you guys. We'll see you next week.